from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, who would have thunk it? Back in London. Didn't expect it, but suddenly, here I am. For a good long while, I'm doing a play here, which opens in a couple of weeks. So if you are making vacation plans this summer, the play is called Daytona, new play. So if you're making vacation plans, come on over to London and come see Daytona. It's a far better vacation idea than going to Daytona and seeing London. I'll tell you that. Ladies and gentlemen, it really depends where you get your news. It's obvious, but the obvious bears repeating, doesn't it? That's what broadcasting is all about. One case in point, the story of Common Core, the Common Core education standards that have been adopted by most of the states in this country, and the William and Melinda Gates Foundation. Today's Washington Post carries a generally upbeat account of how the Gates Foundation helped sweep Common Core, Gates Foundation, with its backing of the adoption of Common Core, the support of it by organizations on both the left and right, from the teachers' unions to the chambers of commerce, and its advocacy. You know, here's a sample op-ed you could write, you could sign your name to, had succeeded in the very swift adoption of these almost national educational standards. Several states have now had second thoughts and pulled out. So it's not national after all, which was the goal. On the other hand, there's this website called Pando Daily. Don't ask me why it's called that, which ran a big story this week on how a series on PBS showing teachers how to use Common Core in their practice was funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Very redolent of the example we had a few months ago in this broadcast of a three-part series on PBS on the public employee pension crisis, quotes, being underwritten in large part by a billionaire who'd spent the last 15 years crusading against public employee pensions. Please give. Also, it again depends where you get your news. In today's London Times, a source unnamed tells the paper that in the year since the Snowden revelations, the British equivalent of NSA, GCHQ, they got one more initial. They got to be better. Lost the ability to track a lot of gangs. They were using these techniques to track criminal gangs. Forget about terrorists, criminal gangs. They didn't get to, they're not following the criminal gangs anymore. But if you read The Guardian, another London newspaper, you read a story that avers that the attempt to rein in abuses in mass surveillance, announced with a certain amount of flourish by the president earlier this year, has not so much been derailed as mothballed, not even in committee in the House. After the committees had voted on the text, then they retreated behind closed doors. And who showed up behind closed doors? But lawyers from the NSA. Because they like closed doors, don't you see? And now those reforms have been allegedly vitiated. Speaking of which,
once I had a secret that lived within the heart of me.
Dateline San Francisco, a federal judge this week ordered the federal government not to destroy any more documents and to file a brief responding to a request for an emergency hearing.
My secret's no secret anymore.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation had claimed in an emergency application the government is still destroying records of NSA spying in violation of a court order. I spit on your court order. U.S. District Judge Jeffrey White quickly ordered the government not to destroy any more materials. In communications with the government this week, EFF was surprised to learn the government has been continuing to destroy evidence relating to the mass interception of internet communications it is conducting under the FISA Amendments Act, even though the court explicitly ordered it to stop in March, said the EFF legal director. Specifically, the government is destroying content gathered through tapping into the fiber optic cables of AT&T, unquote. If the government does it, it can't be illegal, right? Meanwhile, Vodafone, one of the world's largest mobile phone groups, has revealed the existence of secret wires that allow government agencies to listen to all conversations on its network, saying they are widely used in some of the 29 countries in which it operates in Europe and beyond. There's something beyond Europe? Don't tell Christine Lagarde. The company has broken its silence on government surveillance in order to push back against the increasingly widespread use of phone and broadband networks to spy on citizens. This is according to The Guardian, and will publish its first law enforcement disclosure report. This is the most comprehensive survey yet of how governments monitor the conversations and whereabouts of their people. Vodafone, which used to be part-owned by Verizon, I don't think it is anymore, or vice versa. Who can keep track of these owners and mergers? The company said wires had been connected directly to its network and those of other telecom groups, allowing agencies to listen to or record live conversations and, in certain cases, track the whereabouts of a customer. Privacy campaigners said the revelations were a nightmare scenario that confirmed their worst fears on the extent of snooping. In Albania, Egypt, Hungary, India, Malta, Qatar, Romania, South Africa, and Turkey, it is unlawful to disclose any information related to wiretapping or interception of the contact of phone calls and messages, including whether such capabilities exist. Quote, for governments to access phone calls at the flick of a switch is unprecedented and terrifying, said the director of a human rights group in England, Shami Chakrapati. In about six of the countries in which Vodafone operates, the law either obliges telecom companies to install direct access pipes or allows governments to do so. Those don't require warrants. So it's a thing. And it just keeps spreading. Maybe we just should all dummy up. Hello, welcome to the show.
Strong, you can swim inside it. We could string some lights up the hill beside it. Tonight the moon's so bright you could drive with your headlights out. 'Cause a little bit of summer's what the whole year's all about. You look fine, put your feet up next to mine. We can watch that waterline get higher and higher. Say, 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 ain't it been some kind of day? You and me been catching on like a wildfire. That borderline get a higher and higher. Say, 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 ain't it been some kind of day? You and me been catching on like a wildfire. Say, say, say.
from London, England, where sun doesn't set now until like 9 or 10 o'clock. What is this, Sweden? I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersole Jr. These days, the International Olympic Committee has a new crisis on its hands, finding cities willing to host the Games. How about your town? The race for the 2022 Winter Olympics is a case in point, reports the New York Times. High costs and internal political opposition prevented several potential contending cities from even bidding. Two candidate cities withdrew. Two others could still drop out. The way things are going, the winner could be decided next year by default. Quote, I've never seen anything like this before, said Gerhard Heiberg, a senior Norwegian International Olympic Committee member. This is urgent, he says. We need to sit down. I thought he was sitting down. And discuss what is going on. We are at a crossroads here. Well, that's the last place you want to sit down, sir. Excuse me. Get up. Get off the... It's a challenge the IOC and its new president, Thomas Bach, need to resolve quickly to ensure the long-term viability of one of the world's most prized sports events. Changes in the bidding process and efforts to reduce the costs of the Games are among the key issues being addressed by IOC, as a part of Bach's Agenda 2020. Watching closely are countries and cities considering whether to bid for the even bigger and more expensive Summer Olympics of 2024. The financial burden is worrying potential host cities, specifically the $51 billion price tag associated with February's Winter Olympics in Sochi. The public perception is that Games cost too much. Concern over Rio's delayed preparations for 2016 have further dampened enthusiasm for hosting the Games. The Olympics continue to draw huge audiences on television, but the field for 2022 has taken one hit after another. Munich and St. Moritz, Davos, withdrew planned bids when voters in Germany and Switzerland voted in referenda against pursuing the Olympics. Stockholm, one of the five declared candidates, pulled out in December after the city government declined to offer financial backing. What is wrong with them? They're never going to get a Super Bowl that way. On Monday, the Polish city of Krakow dropped out after 70% of voters rejected the bid in a referendum. I'm beginning to think we have to blame the referendums. That leaves four cities in contention: Almaty, Kazakhstan, Beijing, Lviv, Ukraine, and Oslo. The bid from Lviv has been in limbo because of a little thing, something going on in Ukraine. Most worrying for the IOC is the uncertain status of the Oslo bid. Polls show 60% of Norwegians are opposed. In May, one of the two parties in the country's governing coalition came out against the bid. The government will not decide until the fall whether to provide the required financial guarantees. Resistance has arisen in places like Oslo. We have an image problem, Heiberg said in an interview. People in Norway say we have the Games. People in Norway say we love the Games, but we hate the IOC. Oslo hosted the 52 Winter Olympics. Would have been the natural favorite. The 1994 Games in Lillehammer were widely described as the best ever. If there's a referendum today, the no side will win by a large margin, says Heiberg, who organized Lillehammer. But this could change. We have time. Amid the instability, Almaty and Beijing stand as the most solid bids. Beijing is bidding to become the first city to host both the Winter and Summer Games. Almaty, in Kazakhstan, hosted the Asian Games. But has the situation reached a stage where the Olympics can only be held in non-democratic countries where money is no object? No public referendums are being held in either Beijing or Almaty. Kazakhstan has been ruled by the same leader since 1989, who gives money to Tony Blair to help buff the image of Kazakhstan. Both countries have been criticized for their human rights records. The current crisis centers primarily on the Winter Games. Which also raise concerns over whether rising temperatures will prevent countries from even holding the event. in future decades. But wait, there's more. We hear now from the mayor of Rio de Janeiro. Brazil was overly ambitious in its plans for the World Cup. Speaking of which, you familiar with the scandal enveloping the World Cup right now? A certain businessman from Qatar paid off, distributed funds to certain countries, which then voted to have the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. Yeah. Anyway, Brazil was overly ambitious in its plans for the World Cup, but will nevertheless pull off a good event, said the mayor of Rio. Up till now, there's been huge damage to our reputation. There is when you don't have everything done, said Eduardo Paes. We made mistakes. We shouldn't have done 12 stadiums. We should have done fewer cities. That's what brought us to the situation. With just a week to go, much of the infrastructure isn't ready. For example, 11 of 12 airports, including Rio's, are unfinished. Airport Schmairport and the Sao Paulo Stadium, which will host the opening game, has not held and will not hold a test game with a full crowd. Quote the mayor of Rio, "We're Latinos. We're Latins. We're not used to keeping it, to deadlines, to keeping up with things." Unquote the mayor of Rio de Janeiro. He said a recent public lambasting by the International Olympic Committee, which said preparations to date for 2016 were the worst ever, was, quote, "not a good experience," unquote. Quoting again the mayor of Rio, "We will always try to correct things that are going badly, to work with transparency and show them we are doing things our way, the right way," unquote. But the scolding clearly rankled. He reiterated that Rio will not be talked into building, quote, "white elephants," unquote, by the demands of the presidents of individual sporting federations. Quote, "Our lack of infrastructure is the reason we won the bid. If the games are about change and a meaningful legacy, you should not go to Madrid or Chicago or Tokyo. They have everything compared to Rio. Compare Rio to Rio. Don't go looking in London. It's about a subway for Rio." That's the Olympic movement. It is a movement, ladies and gentlemen. And we all need one. Every day. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what the frack? One of North America's leading experts on groundwater contamination has called the shale gas industry, quote, "a mess," unquote, and warned that no Canadian jurisdiction has set up proper monitoring to protect groundwater in areas of intense oil and gas activity. John Cherry, a contaminant hydrologist, well, what does he know about polluting water, who recently chaired an expert federal panel in Canada on the impact of fracking, also lamented the fact of science on the technology. You don't want science now? Gee. A professor emeritus at Waterloo University, who studied industrial contamination of groundwater for decades and developed effective monitoring tools, also issued a blunt warning: if government fails to find adequate science, to fund adequate science on the mining technique or address legitimate public fears, then the shale gas fracking industry could follow nuclear power and lose its social license to operate. Leave it to a Canadian to use a phrase like social license. "Both forms of energy are in trouble for similar reasons," said Cherry, "including waste disposal liabilities," yeah, "technical overconfidence," yeah, "and the public's loss of faith in regulatory agencies." It's the big three. He outlined a number of research gaps for the industry that now underpins British Columbia's multi-billion dollar liquefied natural gas plans. "Scientists have little understanding about possible connections between shallow freshwater zones and the deep zones where mining occurs, or how methane might take advantage of pathways between them," he said. Quote, "Hydrologists understand the freshwater zone and petroleum engineers understand the deep zone, but nobody understands the intermediate zone." Anybody here understand the deep? I see a hand in the corner. In other words, the scientific community knows little about how the repeated puncturing of the middle zone might allow methane to creep to surface or into groundwater. Cherry rated well integrity as one of the most important issues in terms of groundwater contamination and climate change. "Well bore leakage has polluted groundwater, released methane into the atmosphere, and created flammable hazards for households and buildings across Western Canada. A 2012 German study on fracking also identified the long-term stability of cement jobs on well bores as a crucial and unresolved issue for the industry." Here's a quiz. What was the main vector of weakness leading to the blowout at Deepwater Horizon? Wasn't it the cement job? Sounds like a noir movie, the cement job. But you know what I mean? You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Check it. Studies on the impacts of leaking methane from shale deposits or intermediate zones and its effects on groundwater quality are lacking. One study by Duke University found that methane contamination of domestic water wells increased dramatically 1 kilometer away from dense shale gas, i.e. fracking, activity. The natural gas goes into groundwater and is eaten by bacteria, and that changes the quality of the groundwater for better or worse, said Cherry. There isn't a single scientific paper on this topic related to fracking. Industry, government, and media mantras of fracking as problem-free industry stem from a near-total absence of good science and proper groundwater monitoring across North America, according to Cherry. You know what I say, ladies and gentlemen? I say, say it with me. What the frack? And now, it's time for me to read the trades for you. And once again, dipping into the trade magazine of public broadcasting, Current. Analysis finds flat audience for public radio's web streams. Oh, I will read this for you. With special attention to certain public radio stations that say, we're much more than broadcasting. Yes, I'm looking at you. A recent analysis of web metrics for NPR member stations' websites showed continued growth in visits from mobile users, along with declines in cumulative audiences and the amount of time web users spend with content. According to Steve Mulder, director of user experience at NPR. Wait. How come I don't have a director of user experience? Get me on the phone. Mulder drew analytical data from 204 stations that operate 415 web streams. In a comparison of year-to-year data, the cumulative audience for public radio streams dropped 9%, and visitors were listening to a wider variety of content. The total amount of listening time per streaming session remained flat, about an hour. A core group of listeners varied the content that they accessed, he said. But this audience didn't grow, nor did these listeners spend more time listening. This, he said, is something that should raise concerns. Don't disconnect that transmitter yet. The analysis also revealed the vast majority of listeners tuned into stations' live broadcasts rather than their web streams. Huh. Yes, I'm gloating. A comparison of streaming data analyzed by Nielsen broadcast audience data found that 93% of live NPR content is consumed via over-the-air broadcasts, compared to 6.4% for live streams. Of unique monthly visitors to member station websites grew 117% since the end of 2012, but more recent data is less encouraging. Unique visitors to station sites were flat compared to last May, but dropped by roughly a third within a month. The trends this spring are mixed, Mulder said. It's not good news on reach and cume, but we're not in trouble like commercial radio. It's a cloud with a dark lining. Which is the good part, the cloud or the lining, babe? Get your metaphor straight. Mulder theorized that the growth in mobile visitors, people accessing stations, websites by phone or tablet, they want bite-sized content, as well as a drop in visits to stations' home pages have contributed to the decline. Visitors are increasingly going to public radio sites from social media or search results. They go directly to individual story pages, and they're often expecting to read a news story rather than listen to audio. The data show these visitors leave the site after they're done reading the content that drew them there. Stations must find ways to engage these visitors with more of their web content if they're to get them to spend more time on their websites. Wait, don't leave yet. There's a tote bag. Interest in audio content is a key differentiation point in determining how frequently users visit stations' websites. The heaviest visitors listened to 5 times more audio, but read 3 times less text than the lightest users. Quoting Mulder one more time, text is awesome at driving and acquiring new audiences, but audio is our core differentiator. Well, how else do you expect the director of user experience to talk? Yes, it's a question I directed you, the listening audience, only because I've read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
I heard the warden said I had one more day, one last meal before they carried me away. He said, if we don't have it, we'll go out and get it. Because you don't have to go until we get back with it. So I said, give me 2 dinosaurs, eggs over easy, fried in the butter and not too greasy. Mosquito knees and black-eyed peas, a little small bowl of butter, bebop beans, a zebra tooth, a tag of steak, a whole hippopotamus well baked. Now go and get my dinner, go and get my dinner. If you ain't got it, go out and get it. I ain't gone until you get back. Cup of crocodile tears, a paper wallet melon, and some alligator ears. 2 cross-eyed catfish and some wavy gravy in the left-hand dish. Now go and get my dinner. Go and get my dinner. If you ain't got it, go out and get it. I ain't gone until you get back with it. Now bring me an order of rattlesnake hips, the split of his tongue, and bring both of his lips. Now you have my order, so serve my dish with a female banana. I can't resist. Now go and get my dish.
From London, this is Le Show. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen? Sure, we got that. Dateline Dublin. We're Dublin, our news of the godly this week. Almost 800 babies and children were buried in a mass grave in Ireland near a home for unmarried mothers run by nuns, according to new research, which throws more light on the Irish Catholic Church's troubled past. It's a cloud with a dark lining, I'd say. Cloud with a dark lining. Death records suggest 796 children from newborns to 8-year-olds were deposited in a grave near a Catholic-run home for unmarried mothers during the 35 years it operated from 1925 to 1961. Historian Catherine Corius, who made the discovery, says her study of death records for the St. Mary's home in County Galway suggests that a former septic tank near the home was a mass grave. The septic tank, full to the brim with bones, was discovered in 1975 by locals when concrete slabs covering the tank broke up. Until now, locals believe the bones mainly stemmed from the Great Irish Famine of the 1840s. St. Mary's, run by the Bon Secours sisters, that's good help, isn't it? Was one of several such mother and baby homes in early 20th century Ireland. Thousands of unmarried pregnant women, labeled at the time as fallen women, were sent to the homes to have their babies. The women were ostracized by the conservative Catholic society and were often forced to hand over their children for adoption. The recently discovered death records show that 796 children died from malnutrition and infectious diseases such as measles and TB. Conservative Catholic teaching at the time denied children of unmarried parents baptism and therefore burial in consecrated lands. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. I have wondered this for a little while. A friend of mine teaches at Columbia, and she told me before it became published knowledge that more than half of the faculty at major American universities now are adjunct professors, not tenured faculty. Adjunct professors hired ad hoc for a course at a time with no benefits and no commitment to anything other than you're here until the course ends. So, and paid quite low salaries. At the same time that student tuitions are going up and administrator salaries are going through the roof. And I wondered whether there's any connection. Now, here comes Al Jazeera America, not seen in your area, to say, student debt and the hiring of relatively low-paid adjunct faculty rather than full-time professors have grown fastest at public universities with the highest-paid presidents, according to a new report. University president pay has risen dramatically in the aftermath of the financial crisis, according to the report, which focuses on 25 state universities that pay their presidents almost double the national average. Released by the Institute for Policy Studies, a progressive think tank, the study is called the 1% at State U. Presidents at the 25 universities examined saw their salaries increase almost twice as fast as the national average to nearly $1 million. Early indications since the end of 2012 suggest this trend will continue. Though student debt is rising across the country, at these 25 universities, the report said the level of student debt increased 13% faster than the national average from 2006 through 2012. Student loan debt reached over $1 trillion in 2012. According to the study, the student's debt was inextricably tied to rising salaries for university presidents. Your kids will thank you. How about the new Iraq? We don't hear too much. I'm sure things are fine. They had an election, everything. Oh, a wave of car bombs exploded across Baghdad this week, killing more than 60 people, and militants stormed a university campus in western Iraq. According to security and medical sources, the total of a dozen blasts in mainly Shiite, can I say that on the air, districts of the capital, the deadliest of which occurred where a car bomb left 23 people dead, many of them young men playing billiards. And we'll teach you next time, try snooker. Other bombs went off near a cinema, a popular Jewish shop, and a Shiite mosque. No group immediately claimed responsibility for any of the bombings. The Shiite community is a frequent target for Sunni Islamist insurgents who've been regaining ground and momentum in Iraq over the past year, according to Reuters. Since Thursday alone, militants have seized parts of Ramadi and Fallujah. Remember those names? The two main cities in the mainly Sunni Anbar province. On Saturday, they took control of the campus of Anbar University. Job well done, wouldn't you say? Now news of AFPAC. A leading TV news station which dared to criticize Pakistan's feared spy agency, the ISI, has been ordered off the air after a standoff which has further soured relations between the country's military and politicians. Don't cross the ISI. The channel's president condemned the decision, saying forces of might have prevailed. Many analysts fear this move has cowed the private media, setting back efforts to curb the power of the army in our friend Pakistan. Over on the other side of the line, two bombs hit the convoy of Abdullah Abdullah, the leading candidate in the runoff election for president of Afghanistan. Two bombs hit his convoy as he was driven through the city from one campaign to another on Friday, ripping apart the bulletproof four-wheel drive, blowing the glass out of nearby buildings, and leaving the ground strewn with blood and twisted metal. Abdullah emerged apparently unscathed and condemned the attack. Go figure. President Karzai joined Republicans in this country in condemning the swap deal that freed captive Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. If he's an American, why doesn't he spell it B-O? In exchange for five senior members of the Taliban, Karzai argued that the deal broke international law and violated existing deals with Afghanistan's government. Karzai has often accused the United States of acting unilaterally and not consulting him and his government before acting on Afghan soil. The statement underlined just how bad the relationship between Karzai and the United States has become. He also said the five militants should not have any restrictions placed on them while in Qatar, contrary to American assurances that they will. Quote, if the government of the United States have transferred these Afghan citizens to Qatar to limit their freedom and imprison them, then this is a clear violation of international law, said Karzai's statement. He may be going away or he may not. Reuters reports in central Kabul, a few minutes walk from the ornate presidential office, workmen are putting the finishing touches on an imposing new residence and office complex, the retirement compound of Hamid Karzai. He's constitutionally obliged to step down. But media reports have widely speculated in Afghanistan that Karzai is doing a Putin by stepping down as president, and he will still be pulling the strings behind the scenes. When President Obama turned up surprise visit, because things must be so secure, at Bagram Air Base this past week, President Karzai was offered a meeting with the president, but declined. Washington was not surprised that the meeting did not work out on short notice, said the official. The official said the president, meaning Obama, will likely be speaking by phone with Karzai in the days to come and also looks forward to working with Afghanistan's next president. Yeah, it all sounds pretty complex, but that's just how it looks from here. How does it look from there?
From Afghanistan Public Radio, connecting you to the world beyond your yurt. From the refurbishing presidential palace in downtown Kabul, where old presidents never die, they just kibitz. I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm Hamid. We're Pluck and Schmuck, the Still Here Brothers. Welcome to another edition of Karzai Talk. Today's program comes to you with the assistance of Kabul Cleaners. With the Kabul Cleaners guarantee, your clothes back in 3 weeks, or not.
Well, my younger brother, another slap in the face from our American friends this week.
Oh, my brother, my face has gotten so many slaps from my American friends, my cheeks have stars and stripes and their calluses.
You've gotten so many slaps in the face from the Americans that your nose hairs are now whistling Yaki Doodle.
But on the other hand, we've been glad to welcome our new Indian friends to the palace this week.
Oh, a big improvement.
In many ways.
They're not insulted when we ask them to remove their shoes.
No, they're almost too happy to remove their shoes.
That is true. And they also bring better gifts.
Yes, carved jade elephants instead of miniature Ford Mustangs.
Not even the vintage Mustangs.
No, the 2011 Mustangs.
Thank goodness they didn't give us miniature Chevy Cobalts.
Oh, that would have been a disaster.
Now they're even recalling the miniatures.
Hello, you're on Karzai Talk.
Hello, Hamid. This is Barack, long-time president. second time caller.
Uh-oh. Maybe he wants his miniatures back.
No, you can keep them. That's from when we owned the company. We got them for free.
Sir, sorry I couldn't respond to your last-minute invitation to meet you at Bagram Air Base, but I had a commitment that morning.
This is true, Mr. President. Oh. He was getting his dental floss cleaned.
Oh, no, don't you...
that's okay. Mm. That was basically a visit just to tell our troops how proud we are of the job they've done and that they've got to get out of there before all hell breaks loose.
Well, I can assure you, Mr. President, our forces are ready to handle whatever comes their way.
As long as the whatever gives at least 2 days' warning.
Well, I know we've had some tough times. I know you got along better with my predecessor.
Well, it's hard to have a bad relationship with that fellow. Mm. You tell him things and he nods.
But to be fair, it's easy to tell when he's really listening.
Oh, really? How's that?
He nods faster.
Well, as you know, sir, chit-chat is fine here, but...
No, I know protocol demands that I ask a question.
Not just protocol, format.
That's right.
Well, Hamid, I was just wondering, what role you expect to play once the results of the second election have been announced?
You're assuming they will be.
I guess I am.
Well, I am good friends with both of the candidates. Mm-hmm. Let me just say, Mr. President, my relationship with either of them will be better than Jay Leno's with Jimmy Fallon.
Hamid, you follow our entertainment news?
If you read the American papers... That's all you can follow.
Anyway, I have answered listeners' questions and given them advice here ever since the first public radio grant came through from your State Department. I would be foolish not to do the same for my distinguished successor.
Foolish? He'd be signing his own death warrant.
Speaking of that grant, I think the State Department wants their tape machines back.
Oh, that's fine. The Chinese helped us go digital. And, Mr. President, if I could give one piece of advice to you.
Oh, sure. It's your show.
Not for long.
Well, unless your probable successor is the victim of an assassination plot.
What kind of country do you think we are? Chad.
Chad. But maybe next time you're going to go behind an Afghan president's back to negotiate with the Taliban, don't at the same time attack that president for attempting to set up talks with the Taliban. It might leave a bad smell in that president's nostrils.
Or it might just be the shashlik he had for lunch.
Thanks for the call.
Oh, I'm still on.
Not anymore.
Moo. That must give you a feeling of power.
Everything gives me a feeling of power, except the presidency. Hello, you're on Cars I Talk.
Hello, this is Emir of Qatar. Short-time Emir, first-time caller.
Qatar, you are right, my brother. The internet is the future of radio.
Did I say that? What do I call you, sir? Your inheritancy?
Not important. I just actually wanted to ask you a question.
Oh, it's like the old days when people wanted to know our opinions.
Oh, you mean before we started joking around?
No, I mean when we really controlled the Interior Ministry.
Go ahead, caller. We don't have much time.
Oh, is this Afghan life coming up?
Not radio time. Lifetime.
Ah, you Asians always were so metaphysical. So, you know we now have 5 Taliban former detainees in our custody.
Yes, in a deal that makes me madder than John McCain on TV.
Precisely. Now, I know you've demanded that our guests have full rights and freedom of movement.
No, because my brother had bought all that American freedom hooey.
And the Americans are insisting that our guests not speak or appear publicly and remain surveilled by us 24/7.
Yes, because the Americans bought all that Russian surveillance hooey.
So, my question, dear sir, is whom shall I choose to anger?
Well, I may be leaving office soon.
True.
But I'll still have an office near the office I'm leaving.
Aha.
The Americans are thousands of miles away, and we're in the neighborhood, you know, in case you need a teaspoon of opium in the middle of the night.
Yes.
And the Americans are withdrawing. They're sick of the whole soccer-playing world. It'll be 20 years minimum before they want to try to fix us again. So
I guess it's okay for the Taliban 5 to be special guests on Qatar's Got Talent?
Just as long as Jermaine doesn't want to sing lead.
Thanks for the call. We had help today from Afghan van lines, official movers of American forces since last February.
Legal services for Karzai Talk from the law firm of Ketchum & Newcomb. I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm Hamid. Join us sometime soon for another edition of Karzai Talk. This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
So sorry.
First, here's Jonah Hill.
Yeah, so unfortunately, this isn't a joke. So this weekend, I was out with some friends, and there was a paparazzi guy, and he was antagonizing me and calling me names, attacking me personally and my family personally. And I was genuinely hurt by this and made angry by this. And in response, I wanted to hurt him back, and I said the most hurtful word that I could think of at that moment. And, you know, I didn't mean this in the sense of the word. You know, I didn't mean it in a homophobic way. And I think that that doesn't matter. You know, how you mean things doesn't matter. Words have weight and meaning. And the word I chose was grotesque. And, you know, no one deserves to say or hear words like that. And, you know, I've been a supporter of the LGBTQ community my entire life. And I completely let the members of that community and everybody else down when I used a word like that this weekend. And my heart's broken. And I genuinely am deeply sorry to anyone who's ever been affected by that term in their life.
Okay. How many syllables? Oh, forget it. General Motors this week apologized to families of accident victims who've been notified to bring in cars for replacement of defective ignition switches. Quote, "We are deeply sorry to those families who received a recall notice. GM has recalled 2.6 million of its most popular models to replace a defective switch that is linked to 13 fatalities. Some families who have lost loved ones in fatal crashes complained that GM should not have sent them notices to bring in the cars for repairs. Pharrell Williams, singer, fine singer, has apologized for the cover of Elle magazine in the United Kingdom here, where he's photographed wearing a Native American-styled headdress instead of his usual buffalo hat. People were upset over the cultural appropriation of the headdress. Pharrell quickly stepped forward and apologized in a statement sent to BuzzFeed. I respect and honor every kind of race, background, and culture. I am genuinely sorry. The hat swap appears to have likely been at the urging of the staff of Elle. Tom?
Elle.
Close. USA Swimming CEO Chuck Wilgus has publicly apologized for two sexual abuse victims for the first time since the scandal came to light 4 years ago. I'm sorry, he said to open the statement. These are powerful words some people have wanted to hear from me for a long time. I have been criticized in blogs and most recently in the petition opposing my induction into the International Swimming Hall of Fame for not apologizing, for not having done more to prevent sexual abuse by coaches. I wonder if Mr. Bobinette is still alive. Wilga said it became more difficult since 4 years when he said he had nothing to apologize for. I remained, if not defiant, at least defensive. I talked about all the good that USA Swimming was doing in a fight to eradicate sexual abuse, but I never apologized. As time progressed, I became afraid my sincerity would be questioned. Anyway, he's apologized. Dateline Bellingham, Washington. The Washington drama teacher has apologized after she conducted an award ceremony that included jokes about priests having sex with children and sex toys. Wow, that's not the Bellingham my parents moved away from. Dateline Washington, an official at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, apologized this week to service members in the Obama administration after his tweet suggesting there could be questions about the military records of former platoon mates of Bo Bergdahl. Well, I just wanted to make the point that the public should wait before passing judgment. I unfortunately used my own poor judgment in choosing inappropriate language that many view as disparaging to U.S. service members, said Brandon Friedman, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Public Affairs at HUD. That was certainly not my intent, and I regret making the comments on my personal account in such a way. In a series of tweets Wednesday night, Friedman called growing dismissal of Bergdahl as a traitor by some administration critics as premature. He then went on to suggest that some who served with Bergdahl and are now criticizing him in the media could be trying to cover up their own feelings. Quote, what if his platoon was long on psychopaths and short on leadership, unquote. I think the whole world is long on psychopaths. Search giant Google has apologized for a row, criticized by not honoring the 70th anniversary of D-Day via its Google Doodle. The search giant instead briefly posted a doodle on its UK site honoring a Japanese Go player who was born on June 6, 1829. Sorry about that. Gatorade apologized for comments posted to the company's Twitter feed after LeBron James cramped up and had to leave Game 1 of the NBA Finals. The tweets were not deleted. James needed intravenous fluids after the game. The air conditioning went out in the arena, and temperatures were nearly 90 degrees. Our apologies for our response to fans' tweets during the game, said Gatorade in a press release. We got caught up in the heat of the battle. I wonder if they intended that. As a longtime partner of the Miami Heat, we support the entire team. James is an endorser of a Gatorade rival, Powerade. He appeared to be drinking Gatorade at least once during Game 1. When you cramp up during the finals, you'll drink anything. Maxim Magazine has apologized for publishing an ad in its June issue that many in the trucking industry found offensive. In a statement published on its website, Maxim said the ad has been removed from its digital editions. The ad for a personal injury law firm looking to defend accident victims was illustrated using the front of a big rig in a menacing-looking fashion beneath large headline type reading, quote, serial killer, unquote. Justin Bieber is apologizing twice. He found himself in hot water this week when a video surfaced of him at 14 making racially insensitive comments. He replaced the word girl in his hit single One Less Lonely Girl with the N-word as he jokes about killing African-Americans and joining the Ku Klux Klan. He's a Canadian. He issued an apology following the firestorm. Facing my mistakes from years ago has been one of the hardest things I've ever dealt with, he said. But I feel now that I have to take responsibility for those mistakes and not let them linger. At the end of the day, I have to step up and own it. The video surfaced June 4th. Footage made its way online just days after another clip was unveiled, showing Bieber using the N-word as well, tossing around the slur as the punchline of a racist joke. He's a Canadian. He doesn't know. And the editor of a prominent Chinese newspaper has apologized after saying in a tweet suggesting some soldiers in China's war with Vietnam shirked participation. Ooh, you don't want to be doing that in China. And a sports reporter who covers Mississippi State University for a newspaper in Columbus, Mississippi, is apologizing for slagging Lafayette, Louisiana on a sports talk show on the air. He called Lafayette the worst place in America. He doesn't need to apologize. He needs to travel. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show, written and performed by yours truly, Harry Shearer. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ. The planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave. Those waves can't go through a building, or can they? On the Mighty 104 in Berlin, on your available around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want it, at harryshearer.com and kcsn.org. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast from wwno.org, Sideshow Network, SoundCloud, and iTunes, among other places. And it'd be just like Bo Bergdahl spelling his first name B-O, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, in Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead and Jenny Lawson at WWNO in New Orleans, and thanks to Adrian Bodnam here at Global Radio in London for help with today's broadcast. The email address for this program, playlist of the music heard here on, and, gee, what a coincidence, Cars I Talk t-shirts, all available at harryshearer.com. If you're on Twitter, so am I, at the Harry Shearer. I'm this close to 100,000 followers. No pressure. Can you see how close this close is? Well, I'm going to go out and wait for the sunset. It'll be a while. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. Oh, if you're in Los Angeles, Judith Owen and the whole band at the Mint this Friday. Highly recommended. So long from London.